From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It was his job that got Eric Weiner thinking about happiness. He's a correspondent for National Public Radio, and in his new book, he confesses he's never really been a happy guy. Makes sense when you consider the kinds of stories he's covered over the years, wars and disasters. So at some point, Weiner set off to find happiness. That is, the places in the world where most people describe themselves as happy. He began with the research, the studies and papers, but nowhere in any of that, he says, did he find any mention of the happiness a nation derives from art or culture or relationships. Some things, he writes, are beyond measuring. Today on the program, Eric Weiner is joining us to talk about the atlas, the roadmap of happiness he constructed on his own journey to answer a basic question. What are the essential ingredients for the good life? Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, NPR correspondent Eric Weiner will join us to talk about his book called The Geography of Bliss. But first, an update on the 2008 legislative session. KUER's Tasha Cook spent the day yesterday on Utah's Capitol Hill. She's been reporting on a health care reform proposal that's expected to be one of the focuses of this year's legislative session. And Tasha Cook, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug.
Well, before we talk about the details of or the particulars of the bill, give us some sense of the problems that lawmakers are trying to sort of deal with here.
Well, Doug, really one of the major concerns is the uninsured. The latest estimate puts it at 300,000 Utahns who do not have health insurance. That's one in eight residents here in the state. Mm. And, you know, the number of uninsured is expected to grow as more businesses stop providing health insurance. And also, health insurance premiums are rising. They're really skyrocketing at this point. And the reality is that in Utah over the past 10 years, wages really haven't kept up. Mm. The average household income hasn't really kept up with the pace of insurance premiums. So that's the reason why the governor and the legislature are really taking up the issue of health care this year.
Yeah. So the details are starting to kind of become clear. Talk a little bit about how it works, the bill that that they're discussing these days.
Well, Representative Dave Clark is sponsoring House Bill 133, which he says is a way to keep down costs, create better access, and also to improve quality. And the way to achieve those goals, he says, is really about market forces. Right. It will be a system where customers are buying and companies are selling health insurance. And the way it will work is there will be a $750 in tax credit for certain households that still hasn't been spelled out yet to buy private health insurance. This will ultimately amount to a $14 million tax cut program, because tax credit means tax cut.
Sure.
There will also be a task force made up of state agencies with input from Governor John Huntsman and the legislature. Under the bill, the task force would come up with a plan of action by November. And so details will be spelled out by the task force.
Yeah. So they're not going to pass anything now. They're just sort of studying at this point. So talk a little bit about the concerns. How's it being received, this idea on the Hill?
Well, at yesterday's hearing, there were about a dozen speakers who came forward to testify. They were comprised of Utah residents, small business owners, insurance company representatives who spoke in favor and also in opposition to the bill. Supporters of the bill, mainly comprised of insurance companies and small business advocacy groups. Representative Stephen Clark, who's also a Republican, raised questions about whether the November deadline is giving the task force enough time, because it's only 1 year. There appears to be bipartisan support for the notion of health care reform. There were questions raised by the Democrats on the committee about whether the task force would benefit with more public input and perhaps an advisory board. That was shot down, but it was passed along party lines and with the Democrats objecting to it.
So there's this controversy apparently about a particular provision of Clark's bill that prohibits the enrollment of some children in what's called the Children's Health Insurance Program. How does that work?
Well, this provision in particular is really worrisome for advocates of children here in the state. The Children's Health Insurance Program, otherwise known as CHIP, is federally funded. And under the plan, it would prohibit the enrollment of a child in CHIP if the child's parent would qualify for these new state tax subsidies for private insurance. And for advocates for children, there is concern that the private insurance available to these families might not be adequate. Mm.
Okay, let's talk about Jenny Brundin's at the Capitol now. She's been following developments with a House bill that is supposed to repeal a Utah law that allows undocumented immigrants to get driving privilege cards. We talked a bit about it yesterday. What's the latest on that?
Well, the latest news right now is House Bill 239 passed. It passed on a 6-3 vote. It was pretty contentious, highly emotional, with minority advocates upset, opponents declaring that, you know, they're taking over the country. Sure. That kind of language was used. The bill's sponsor, Glenn Donaldson, says the cards would really undermine national security if this was repealed. Opponents argued, though, that 76% of those with licenses have insurance, and that really it would hurt the entire community if this were to be repealed. And a representative from the Catholic Diocese was concerned with the treatment of undocumented immigrants, citing concern about humane treatment of them and if they would be treated differently. So right now it goes to the House floor, that bill.
Yeah, so that's That issue seems to be a focus, immigration. Okay, KUER's Tasha Cook. Tasha, thanks very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Early in his journey to find the happiest places on Earth, NPR reporter Eric Weiner was told by a prominent happiness researcher, yes, there is such a person, that he may not like what he finds. And to be sure, along the way, he had to abandon the conventional of wisdom where you might find happy people. You would think, for example, people in tropical countries, you know, with white beaches and balmy weather, would be happy. Well, as it turns out, not so much, at least not in the way researchers measure happiness. Not to give everything away up front, but Weiner discovered that religion doesn't necessarily mean happiness either, at least not any more than good weather does. The fact is, Weiner's journey revealed a certain truth about happiness, but no clear pattern. The Swiss, for example, are a pretty uptight people, and yet they're pretty happy. The Thais, they're laid back, but happy. Icelanders, for example, like to drink, and they're happy. But Moldovans also drink, but as a country, they're a pretty miserable lot. Eric Weiner has written a book about his journey, and today on the program, he's joining us to talk about it. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. The book is called The Geography of Bliss, One Grump's Search for the Happiest Places in the World. And we should also mention that Eric has been thinking of the book as the beginning of a kind of conversation. So since he's been writing it, he's been asking people to say, what are their happiest places? So we invite you to join the conversation. Tell us what might be your favorite country or city or state, your happiest place, 801-585-WEST, again the number. As an NPR correspondent, Eric Weiner's work has led him to more than 30 countries, including Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran. He's also written for newspapers like the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times. And Eric is joining us today from the studios of NPR in Washington. And Eric Weiner, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. I'm happy to be here.
There's the word.
Yeah, you can't escape it, can you?
You can't. I wanted to start with the thing that seems to have motivated you. I mean, you've spent, as we said, years covering the world in some pretty tragic events, you know, conflict and disaster. And this seems to be, in some ways, the thing that kind of motivated your search. You were looking for something, you know, happy, uplifting. Is that right?
Right. I mean, people say to me, well, you know, you're a grump. What does a grump know about happiness? And my reply is, well, you know, what does a hungry person know about food? Well, you're motivated to find it. Yeah. And as you suggest, and as the subtitle of my book suggests, I am not a particularly happy person, and I found myself in a profession that sort of trades in misery to some extent, that of a foreign correspondent. And, you know, for NPR, I traveled to, as you said, more than 30 countries, most of them pretty miserable places, to be honest, places like Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Sudan. That's what foreign correspondents do. But it can get to you after a while. Mm. And as I've traveled around the world, I've always, out of the corner of my eye, taken note of these sort of unheralded happy spots and made a vow to myself to one day to explore them more thoroughly. And that's what I've done in the book.
Do you think, Eric, that this was that this was more than just an academic or journalistic pursuit. I mean, for you, it seems like it's a pretty personal book in many ways.
Well, it is personal. I don't know how you can write about a subject like happiness and not get personal, because it is subjective. In fact, the academics call happiness subjective well-being. That's what it is. And look, I try to sort of drop my journalistic guard in this book. And while I still used a lot of the sort of research tools that I've developed as a journalist, I tried to also get personal and make this a personal journey, and to, you know, be willing to share my vulnerability, shall we say, with the reader, and not just be this sort of, you know, Walter Cronkite sort of picture of perfect journalistic objectivity. That's not what I've tried to do here.
Was that hard, to be vulnerable in that way?
I mean, it was, and I found myself sort of catching myself, you know, like I was in Bhutan. Bhutan's this amazing country in the Himalayas with a policy of gross national happiness. We can talk about that later.
Yeah, but, of course.
You know, I was there sitting with a man named Karma, and, you know, you don't – it's not the kind of thing that happens to you every day. And I had to sort of catch myself, like, being, you know, very serious. And and then I would just sort of stop myself and cut right to the chase and say, you know, are you happy? And ask questions that most journalists wouldn't ask. And also to, you know, share with him some problems I've been having in my life. And it is hard. I'm sort of like, I compare myself to the off-duty police officer who's at the Denny's, you know, with his family, but keeps scanning the crowd for potential shooters. You know, he can't drop that guard. I tried as much as I could, though, in the book.
Well, among the things that we learn about you in the book is this pretty intense travel bug. I mean, you write about when you were a kid running away from home in, I guess it was
Baltimore at age five.
Yeah. What is that? Have you, and do you still have it? You've always had it, I guess?
Oh, I've got it. Yeah. It's like there's no cure for this bug. You know, once you've got it for life. And I'm defensive of the art of travel. I really think that it's important. And I know that, you know, a lot of self-help books sort of counsel us that, you know, you could be happy anywhere. And there's, you know, if you're traveling, you must be running away from yourself. I don't buy that. I think, yeah, maybe sometimes you're running away from something, but more often than not, you might be running to something. And I really believe in the redemptive power of travel. I think Henry Miller put it best when he said that one's destination is never a place, but a new way of seeing things. Yeah. And that's the way I've always approached travel and what I've tried to do in this book.
And then, of course, the other thing that we learn about you just by looking at the title is that you confessed you've never really been that happy a guy. You're a bit of a grump.
More of a malcontent, but my publisher thought malcontent was too many syllables and sounded vaguely French.
Yeah.
So we went with grump, but you get the idea.
Yeah.
No, not particularly happy. I don't know why. I work for NPR. That's happy. I have a lovely wife and daughter, and I should be happy, but I'm not, and that's been kind of a mystery. And it's, you know, it's not outright depression. I don't suffer from, you know, clinical depression or anything like that. It's more, I don't know if you're old enough to remember terms like wow and flutter and harmonic distortion. These are sort of the the terms that high fidelity people would use to describe old turntables if they didn't play the music perfectly. Yeah. And that's sort of what it's like. I've always had in the back of my mind, really, this sort of white noise of unhappiness that sort of degraded the quality of my experience in my life.
So is it too much to say that that the book for you in some way was a way of, I mean, because you talk, we'll talk about this as we go along. You said you had sort of read pretty much every self-help book that was out there. I mean, was this, at least initially, a form of that? You trying to find a way, a formula, something about happiness?
I guess in a way. I'm wary of the self-help label, I have to be honest. It's true that I've imbibed in what I call the, or been a victim of, depending on how you look at it, the self-help industrial complex.
Yeah,
I've got a whole, you know, bookshelf filled with those books. And I think, I mean, one of the problems with them is that they tend to focus on looking inside of yourself, you know, your inner child, your inner, you know, talk show host, whatever you're getting in touch with. And while that is helpful to some extent, it can also become very narcissistic and ultimately counterproductive because, you know, I believe, and certainly after researching this book, I really believe that a lot of our happiness is outside of ourselves. It's in our relationships with other people, with the environment. You know, it's the country we live in. It's the culture that we swim in, you know. And And so to that extent, I hesitate to call this book a self-help book, while certainly I would hope people would get something out of it, that they would, you know, have what they call in the business a takeaway or something to take home with them. But, you know, I'm not professing to have all the answers. I'm in that sense, I'm very much the journalist sort of trying to figure things out.
Well, we've talked about it, how this sort of pursuit of happiness is kind of a uniquely modern American malady, that there's this kind of expectation that we have that we're supposed to be happy.
Yeah, and that's relatively new. Yeah. We may not realize that living in this country, but, you know, for most of human history, happiness was reserved for the gods or the fortunate few. It wasn't for, you know, everyday schlubs like you and I. Mm. No offense, you know. I mean, it was an exceptional state, and, you know, now it's something that everyone not only is told that we can achieve, but as you say, we're expected to achieve. And expectations are the surest way to kill happiness. And so we do suffer from what one historian calls the unhappiness of not being happy. Mm. And it's a pretty miserable state to be in.
Eric Weiner is with us. He's a national correspondent for National Public Radio. His book is called The Geography of Bliss, One Grump's Search for the Happiest Places in the World. We'd like to hear your happiest places, or you can just join the conversation, questions or comments. 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, NPR reporter Eric Weiner is with us to talk about his book, The Geography of Bliss. Weiner set off to find happiness at some point. This is the world's happiest countries he was looking for to explain why they seem to be happier than others. There's one question at the heart of the book. What are the essential ingredients for the good life? Eric Weiner is joining us. We invite you to join us as well with questions or comments or your happiest place. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call. Aaron is with us in West Jordan, Utah. Aaron, welcome.
Hello today.
Hi, Aaron. Welcome. Sorry.
You know, it's kind of funny. My happy place, my wife and I, tongue-in-cheek, have discussions about is basically where, you know, you want to be buried. And my parents have a cemetery and some 60 acres back in a holler in West Virginia, and it's the greatest place to go back to when I need a little break from life. And, you know, you've suffered some setbacks, and it's, you know, nice treat area and green and certainly a little, you know, Walden Pond type. But, you know, you just can't get past it. I mean, it really is actually the happiest place in life is where you want to be buried.
Hmm. I think Aaron raises an interesting point, and one that's sort of echoed in my book. I was talking to an Icelandic film director, and we were talking about, you know, what is home?
Yeah.
You know, what, especially for Americans, we move around constantly. So what is really home? And he said to me, well, the definition of home is how you answer this question, where do you want to die? Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what Aaron's saying. And
yeah.
I agree with him that is a good determinant of what we really consider to be home. And another thing is that, to my surprise, the subject of death came up a fair amount in my travels and my research, and more than you might think in a book about happiness. But, you know, essentially, you know, I was told by this man, Karma, who I met in Bhutan and who really made a huge impression on me. I sort of shared with him some anxiety I was having or some sort of mild panic attacks, you might call them. And he said to me, he said, well, your problem is that you need to think about death for 5 minutes every day and you'll be cured of this anxiety. And I just thought, whoa, what are you talking about, Karma dude? I mean, it just, why would I want to think about death for 5 minutes every day? But I realized that he was onto something, that, you know, we in the West in particular, we don't like to talk about or even think about death. We sort of push it down, you know, sweep it under the carpet, and it tends to back up on us and express itself in some unhappy ways.
He said it sanitizes you. That was the word he used.
Yeah, we live in a sanitized world, and we don't touch rotten things or deal with dead bodies. I mean, if you think about it, in a culture like Bhutanese culture, if a relative dies, it's the family members who prepare the body for cremation, not strangers. Mm. So I think the caller was really onto something.
Yeah. Aaron, glad you called. Thanks very much. 801-585-WEST is the number. So let's just, for a moment, Eric, define our terms. Your favorite definition, I guess, of happiness, you say in the book, came from Noah Webster, and it's pretty straightforward. Right. What is it? Agreeable sensations.
Let's see if I can do it off the top of my head. Okay. The agreeable sensations that spring from the enjoyment of the good. How's that? That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
The agreeable sensations that spring from the enjoyment of the good. Now, first of all, I should point out that Noah Webster was not a particularly happy man. He was a famous grump. So, but I like this definition because it has a little bit of everything. It has agreeable sensations, which is sort of this hedonistic definition of happiness, you know, pleasure basically, from the enjoyment, and enjoyment is a slightly higher state of mind than just sort of animal pleasure, from the good, you know, which is a great, you know, phrase there. And you know, I think by the good he meant, you know, not finger licking good, that kind of good, but but the capital G good, like in the sort of more metaphysical sense.
Sure.
And so it has the sort of, you know, hedonistic element to it. And it has this idea that really we've lost this sort of ingredient in happiness, this sort of sense that happiness is more transcendent and is part of living a good life. You know, I mean, Aristotle defined happiness as a virtuous activity of the soul, which is pretty heavy stuff, and not the way we define happiness today. It's really become synonymous almost with just pleasure, don't you think?
I mean,
it's lost sort of that deeper meaning.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's my favorite definition.
Well, and then to the word geography in the title, which as you sort of said a moment before, that it's kind of about culture. And you say that you came across this geographer, Yi Fu Tuan, who helped you get the sense of geography. Talk a bit about that, if you would.
I mean, he's an amazing person. I've never met him. He's Chinese-American, professor emeritus now, I believe, at the University of Wisconsin. Written probably more than a dozen books on the subject of geography, but in a very human way. He basically is a man who is in love with place and the sense of place. And I've read his books, and it really fired my imagination. This notion that basically where we are affects who we are. And I know that it's sort of a counterintuitive idea these days because we live in a world where supposedly geography is dead, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sitting here in Washington talking to you in Salt Lake City via, you know, the magic of technology. And, you know, now with iPhones and online and being wired, you can be anywhere. But I think that's overstated, really. I think that where we are does affect who we are. And by where, I don't just mean, you know, the physical environment, the climate, but also the culture that we're in. We can't really escape that. And that's what I tried to do in the book, was explore how geography, with a capital G, including culture, you know, determines our mood and our happiness.
Mm. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us, 801-585-9378. Let's go back to the phones. Bethany is with us in Salt Lake. Bethany, hi.
Hi. We have a severely handicapped son that has taught us a lot about happiness. It's interesting. He will be going through something that is a difficult struggle for him. And the second that it is over, it's thank you, and he's so, so happy. And we've sort of been taught by him that if we're grateful in everything and have humor, that life is a lot happier.
Are you seeing a parallel, Eric Weiner, to that philosophy there and what you found in Thailand, which was sort of don't think about it too much?
Yeah, which is another way of saying don't dwell about it, dwell on it too much, which I think is what Bethany is pointing out about her son, that, you know, surely he suffers on one level, but he doesn't dwell on the suffering. And, you know, when I was in Thailand, I discovered that they have a fairly common expression that, you know, translates as don't think too much, or you think too much, said in a sort of scolding way. And that really floored me when I first heard that, you know, because I've always, you know, thought, you know, there's the word, we can't escape it in our culture. I've always thought that, you know, if I was unhappy, it's because I wasn't thinking enough, or I was thinking in the wrong way.
Right.
I never thought that thinking itself was the problem, but the Thais believe that. In fact, the Inuit believe it as well, and other cultures do, that the thinking, the very act of thinking, can be counterproductive. And sometimes it's best not to think at all. And I know that that is hard for us to swallow because we value thinking of all kinds in our culture. But sometimes, you know, you just, you know, thinking is like running. Just because you're doing it doesn't mean you're getting anywhere. You might be running backwards or in circles or on a treadmill. And your thinking might be just your wheels spinning. And, you know, that's partly tied to the Buddhist beliefs in Thailand. But it opened my eyes to a new way of thinking or not thinking.
Yeah, yeah. Bethany, glad you called. Thanks. 801-585-WEST, the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I wanted to ask you about sort of the relationship between the study of happiness and science. Because, as you said, science sort of ignored the idea of happiness as a kind of research subject for, you know, for centuries.
For a long time, You know, and that... And they've come around in the last few decades and really even the last few years. And now psychologists, sociologists, and even economists are studying happiness. They're studying what makes, well, healthy minds and healthy societies as opposed to just diseased ones. And, you know, I think that's a good thing. I applaud that. I do recognize that it is very much a soft science and it's sort of in its infancy. But, you know, in a way it parallels my own sort of, you know, revelation that, you know, that journalism as well or writing books can be on more positive subjects and that doesn't make you soft and squishy. You know, there's something to be said for looking at what works as well as what doesn't work.
I was intrigued by some of the methods they've used over time. Facial coding sounded really intriguing. But in the end, I was really surprised at how incredibly kind of ridiculously simple the process of measuring happiness. They just ask the question.
That's it. Overall, how happy are you with your life these days? That's basically the question they've asked around the world for about 40 years now. And, you know, the idea here is that happiness is subjective, as I said. And so who knows better your level of happiness than yourself? I mean, if you say on a scale of 0 to 10, you know, 0 being miserable, 10 being sort of Oprah levels of happiness, that you're a 7, well, I mean, who am I as a psychologist to argue with that and say, well, no, you say you're a 7, but you're really only a 5 or a 6 or maybe you're a 9. I mean, it is subjective, and the happyologists, as I call them, are insist that it's reliable. That if, you know, if I say, you know, Doug, what's your number? How happy are you? 0 to 10. And I mean, can I ask you what you might say you are?
Oh.
Overall, not at this moment. Maybe you had a bad morning.
I think I'm a typical American. 7 or 8, maybe?
Okay,
7?
That puts you, 7 makes you pretty typical.
Okay.
But then I might ask your friends and say, well, you know, what do you think Duck is? And turns out that more often than not, they tend to agree with your self-assessment. So that's some sort of outside corroboration. So so that's how they do it. No, they're not. They do use MRI scans for research and PET scans and that sort of thing. But that's really in its infancy. And the best sort of method they have for measuring happiness at the moment is, as you say, asking people.
801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Let's go back to the phones. Debbie is with us in South Jordan. Debbie, hi.
Hi, Doug. Hi, Eric. How you doing?
Happy.
Good. Hey, I just want to make a comment and just make a couple of comments. First of all, I am 38, and I've been diagnosed with clinical depression since I was 16. But I'm actually a very happy person. I just fight the depression on the inside. And so I'm kind of the opposite of Eric, I guess, because I really want to be happy all the time, but I fight the depression all the time. So let me tell you where my happy places are. And when I go there, all the depression goes away. When we go to South America, I've been to Costa Rica and Guatemala, and the poverty is really huge, but the people are always so happy, and they're so good to people, and it just brightens my whole day to see people so happy with nothing. And then I come home, and I think, what am I depressed about? What am I lacking?
Yeah.
And then the other place that we love to go, and we go there every year, is San Francisco. And everybody is, you know, they dress up, they stand on the street, they let you take pictures with them, and they're awesome people. And it seems like everybody is always happy there. The restaurants are great, the food's great, the ocean breeze, and I just love going there.
Debbie, I'm glad you called. Eric, I'm wondering what are the responses you're getting to that question? Do you get
all kinds. Some people will answer it broadly, and I purposely word the question, what's your happiest place, pretty broadly.
Yeah.
And some people will say, an entire continent of Europe, and others will say, this burger joint in their town that they just love,
right.
But I thought it was interesting what Debbie said, because that she suffers from clinical depression, yet she feels better in these places. Now, traditional sort of psychologists might say, well, she's running away from her depression, but I don't see it that way. I think that when we're in a different place, we give ourselves permission to feel differently. Mm-hmm. There's nothing really magical about it. I don't necessarily believe in these energy vortexes that supposedly exist in Sedona, Arizona, and other places. Maybe they exist, maybe they don't. I'm open-minded about that.
Sure.
But I do believe that we, when we travel somewhere, maybe you've had this experience yourself on vacation or even a business trip, and you feel lighter, more buoyant, it's because you have given yourself permission subconsciously to feel differently. And I think that, it's sort of travel shock therapy in a way. It's it's jolting you out of your regular routine. And that's why I am a huge fan of travel when done well, done properly.
Mm. Debbie, thanks very much. 801-585-WEST. Again, that number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I was interested in, you went to the World Happiness
Database. World Database of Happiness. Let's get it right.
That's right. Sorry.
Okay.
And Ruth.
Ruth Veenhoven.
Yes. Which was a sort of fascinating part of the book where you sort of. And I have to say there are a lot of inconsistencies in some ways. Again, there's not much – well, there is some conventional wisdom to happiness. Money can make you happy but not very happy. I mean, there are a lot of different things you sort of –
No, you're right. I mean, there are inconsistencies.
Yeah.
I mean, I would be the first to agree with that it's – on the one hand, let's take religion. People who attend religious services of any kind regularly – tend to be happier, say they're happier than people who don't. But if you look at the happiest countries in the world, there end up being places like Iceland, Denmark, Switzerland, pretty secular places.
Yeah.
So that's just one inconsistency. I mean, there are a huge number. And I after I was sort of at the end of the road, literally and figuratively for the book, I sort of realized, as you do, that there are these inconsistencies. And I called up this Canadian happiness researcher named John Helliwell, and I said, John, what's up with this? There's so many inconsistencies. And he said, well, it's simple. There's more than one path to happiness. And that kind of hit me, that there is no one formula. Money can make you happy or can make you miserable. It really depends how you relate to the money. The Swiss, or it's a very wealthy country, Switzerland, and they seem pretty happy for it for a variety of reasons. But there are other wealthy countries that are miserable. It's the attitude towards the money, for instance.
Well, and this other idea came up when you were in the Netherlands, for example, which you're sort of trying to figure out why people in the Netherlands might be happy. Part of it is, you say, tolerance. And in fact, you say there are three parts, I think sort of tongue-in-cheek, that three parts to Dutch tolerance, cycling, prostitution, and legal soft drugs. And
I was being serious about that.
You were okay.
Yeah.
And then you sort of have this experience with some of these legal soft drugs, and we'll let people read the
book
for research purposes. I know.
I just want to be totally clear about that.
I know.
That.
Okay. So, but then you bring up this question about this Robert Nozick's experience machine, and this question of whether people, if they could, always feel, the sense of happiness and euphoria, the sense of pleasure, would they? And you find that
right.
People don't always want to feel it. There's something good to a kind of, to a cycle, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's the experience machine is Robert Nozick's thought experiment, he called it. And basically it's this. If, say, you could hook yourself up to this experience or happiness machine and you would be happy all the time, you just lie there. It's perfectly safe. You don't have to worry about side effects. You'll just feel happiness all the time for the rest of your life when you want to be hooked up to this experience machine. And most people, I find, answer no, they wouldn't, which is interesting. If we believe that happiness is the highest ideal and we say, well, we want our children just to be happy, that's all. We don't want that, really. As you point out, we want some grit and truth to our lives. We want the rough spots so we can enjoy the smooth ones. And we want to earn our happiness. We don't want it just given to us through this machine or drugs, for instance. So I think it's tricky. Happiness is something that we all aspire to, but we want it on our own terms, and we want to earn it, and we want to also not experience it constantly all the time.
Eric Weiner is with us. He's a national correspondent for National Public Radio, joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington. His book is called The Geography of Bliss, One Grump's Search for the Happiest Places in the World. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the NPR correspondent Eric Weiner. He's talking about his book, The Geography of Bliss. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. Kelly's with us in Kaysville, Utah. Kelly, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I used to think, first of all, I'm a mother of two, and so I used to think if I could just get some time to myself, to, you know, that was my happy place. But then I realized it's not so much that I need time to myself to be happy. I just have the freedom to feel however I want to feel. And I think it's been talked about earlier, the social pressures of being happy when you're around other people, because you don't want to bring them down. You feel obligated to put on your best face. So I get, that was just my comment.
Okay. Glad you called, Kelly.
I think Kelly's right. You know, as we said earlier, there's this pressure to be happy in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she said something interesting. She said that, you know, sometimes she thinks she just wants to be by herself, but then she realizes that's not it.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, the scientists, social scientists studying happiness pretty much know that most of our happiness is derived from our relationships with other people.
Right.
So, you know, I don't think you could be happy on a deserted island by yourself. You know, as much as we may feel that we want that and we desire that, I think after a few days or a few weeks of that, we'd realize that, you know, we were missing this great source of happiness, which is other people. I mean, Jean-Paul Sartre once said that hell is other people, but I think he had it wrong, or was just hanging out with the wrong people. we really, you know, as we need other people for our happiness, and if we feel that, you know, we need time to ourselves, it's probably because, as Kelly suggested, we're under this pressure, this social pressure, to put on a happy face.
Well, this idea of relationships is an important part of the book. I mean, you talk about in Bhutan, which is one of the happier countries in the world. You write that happiness is not a personal notion; it's a collective notion.
Right. I mean, my friend Karma, to bring him back in, he keeps popping up. He said, we were sitting down having tea, and he said to me, he said, Eric, I don't understand this American notion of personal happiness. There is no such thing as personal happiness. Happiness is 100% relational, he said. And at the time, I thought he was exaggerating to sort of make his point, you know, that we need to focus outside of ourselves. And as I researched the book and as I traveled, I began to think that he meant exactly what he said, that our happiness is 100% relational. It's our relationship with their family, of course, but with friends, with strangers, with the woman who cleans your office, whose name you don't even know. I mean, and that struck me, that, and if you think about it, we do use the term personal happiness, and it's kind of silly. I mean, if we use it, we should use it ironically, if at all.
Mm. You talk about, in terms of Bhutan, the idea of a gross national happiness, which is, sort of sounds charming and quaint, but they're very serious about this idea in Bhutan.
They are. Gross national happiness is their national policy. I mean, it's they still measure economic growth, but they're trying to supplement it with this other measure. Or, yeah, it's a little early to call it a measure. It's a policy, basically, that every decision that the Bhutanese government makes would be seen through this prism of gross national happiness. In other words, they say, well, if we let in another 10,000 tourists next year, will that increase overall happiness in the country or decrease it? Mm. And, of course, the economic answer is, great. More tourists, the better.
Right.
You know, that means jobs and that means income, et cetera. But they have a very deliberate policy of controlling and curtailing the number of foreign visitors to their country. And it's all guided by this happiness principle. And I mean, look, I don't want to make Bhutan out to be this Shangri-La, you know, this paradise. It's not. They have problems and not everyone there is happy. But it is their objective is happiness and not just economic growth.
Well, one thing that was compelling about that part of the book is that this idea of gross national happiness sort of comes down to, I think as you describe it in the book, knowing your limitations, knowing how much is enough, which seems for a lot of Americans a completely foreign concept.
Yeah, if you think about it, right? When is enough? How much economic growth is enough? How much money in your bank account is enough? How much career success is enough? As a culture, we don't really ask that question, and we certainly don't have the answers to it. But that's sort of the fundamental philosophy behind gross national happiness is here's an entire country and a government trying to say, you know, this is enough. We're drawing the line here. And I realize that's sort of counter to the American ethos, which is always bigger, better, faster, you know, and richer. And I think, though, that if you're going to be happy, you have to get a handle on the word enough and come to terms with it.
I want to have you read a section, if you would. There's a section of when you're leaving Bhutan, which I guess, Eric, was kind of hard to leave. I mean, you really grew to love the place while you were there.
I did, and I grew to love to grow very fond of my guide, Tashi, who was sort of shadowing me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it is, I'll read this section, but I mean, I'll just say that it is the kind of place that sneaks up on you and then stays with you. And It's just an amazing place. Should I read it?
Yeah, you're at the airport.
Okay, I'm at the airport and just spent quite a bit of time in Bhutan and sort of sitting there and getting ready to get on a plane for New Delhi in India. I clear customs and security quickly and find myself with plenty of time on my hands before my flight. It's raining outside, and I wonder if it's safe to take off in this weather with the mountains so close, so high. I think about plane crashes more than most people. I know how to fly planes, small ones, and while you'd think this would be a great source of reassurance, for me it has the opposite effect. Every shake or bump or something not quite right strikes fear in me. Is that flap extended properly? Are we descending too rapidly? Doesn't that left engine sound funny? Yet sitting here in this airport terminal that looks like a Buddhist temple, watching an archery match on a small TV screen, and drinking bad instant coffee, I am overwhelmed with a feeling that is alien to me. Calm. Not hashish or alcohol-induced calm, but the real thing. I take out my pen and write the following words in my notebook, using large letters, scrawling across an entire page, so that when they find my body in the wreckage, it will be easier to spot. I would not have done anything differently. All of the moments in my life, everyone I have met, every trip I have taken, every success I have enjoyed, every blunder I have made, every loss I have endured, has been just right. I'm not saying they were all good or that they happened for a reason. I don't buy that brand of pap fatalism. But they have been right. They have been okay. As far as revelations go, it's pretty lame, I know. Okay is not bliss or even happiness. Okay is not the basis for a new religion or self-help movement. Okay won't get me on Oprah. But okay is a start, and for that I am grateful. Can I thank Bhutan for this breakthrough? It's hard to say. Bhutan is not Shangri-La, of that I am sure, but it is a strange place, peculiar in ways large and small. You lose your bearings here, and when that happens, a crack forms in your armor. A crack large enough, if you're lucky, to let in a few shafts of light.
It's Eric Weiner reading from his book, The Geography of Bliss. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Let's go back to the phones. Kevin has been waiting in Salt Lake. Kevin, welcome.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
So how you doing?
Great.
I was just calling because, you know, here you are talking about over in Bhutan and India, and I was thinking about some of my experiences traveling through a lot of Canada and the United States and stopping along the way at ashrams. And I think that some of these places are the happiest places on the planet, you know, the philosophy being, you know, proper breathing, proper diet, proper exercise, positive thinking and meditation, and proper relaxation would bring you happiness. And these people are getting up every morning together as a community and singing, just giving thanks for their life. And, you know, there is reflection upon death, of course, throughout the day as well, to think, you know, our life could be taken from us at any second, at any moment, and are we making the most out of it? And I think that I think these places they've transformed me, really. When I was 19, I was very angry, sad, depressed, and, you know, lost, and I was just traveling by my lonesome around Canada, and I met one character who took me to an ashram, and it had such a profound impact on my life, and I feel ever since then it's steered me in this path of finding happiness within and giving me the tools to find that happiness.
Yeah. Eric Weiner, you want to react?
Well, you know, there's one chapter in the book that takes place in India, and, you know, in the spirit of, you know, being a participant observer, I went to an ashram outside of Bangalore. This is run by a guru named Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, very popular around the world. And I do agree with Kevin that there's something to be said for that sort of detox approach. For me, the most difficult part of the 3 days I spent at the ashram was the rule that, there was a rule against alcohol for 3 days. I can handle that. There was a rule against eating meat. That was okay.
Yeah.
But then the instructor said, and for the next 3 days, no caffeine of any kind, you know, no coffee, no tea, no Coke. That was tough. That was really tough. But in all seriousness, I find that it's helpful to sort of jumpstart your life. The problem, of course, is you can't live in an ashram forever.
Yeah.
You have to leave. And I have that experience that I write about, leaving the ashram after 3 days and going back into India, and this sort of this jolt of being suddenly this, your senses are bombarded again with the noise and the pollution and all the problems of India. So the challenge, and I don't know the answer to this, is how do you go to an ashram and sort of, you know, lead this spiritual life while you're there and sort of detox yourself and then leave and take it home with you. And I mean, there are other problems with ashrams, this sort of guru worship mentality, which frankly rubbed me the wrong way. But I mean, there's something to be said for these places, but I don't know what role they play in sort of a happy life overall.
Well, the other thing I think to remember is some of the other places you went. I mean, for example, you know, you talk about the sort of calm peace of an ashram, but it should be said that Iceland is one of the, if not the happiest place on the world. It's cold. It can be dark. They engage in binge drinking, and they're an incredibly happy people.
Right. And who would have thunk, right?
Exactly.
I mean, it's but it's, you know, that cold, dark part. I mean, we have to get over that myth of you know, that the happiest places in the world, that paradise is, you know, just palm trees and beaches and a drink with a little umbrella in it. I mean, the happiest countries in the world do tend to be cold, dark places like Iceland, Denmark, and Switzerland. The climate doesn't matter as much as we think it does. If you're sitting in cold Michigan or wherever and you think you're unhappy, you might blame it on the climate and think if you were in Miami, you'd be happier. But chances are you wouldn't be. You'd find other reasons to be unhappy.
801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Let's take another call. Bernice is with us in Ogden. Bernice, welcome. Not much time, but welcome.
Hi, thank you. Okay,
sure.
I just want to touch on a couple of things. First, I wanted to touch on the author's perspective on travel. It's so nice to hear about a fellow traveler. I love to travel. I do not see it as a form of escape. When we lived overseas, I was worried about actually being able to move back home because I was waiting for my passport to come back. I needed extra pages. There was not a single spot to get my passport stamped to get back to the States. When I went back to my 25th class reunion, people could not believe everywhere that I had been, and I couldn't believe that they had not gone anywhere. And I think that travel is wonderful. You get to meet so many wonderful people and view so many different ways of life. But then again, that might be because I'm a sociologist, so I don't know. One of the things I think about finding a happy place, one of the reasons I love living over in Okinawa was there's not any road rage. And one of the things I love about that is just because in their culture it's such a slower pace, and you get to slow down. And so I think maybe one of the callers who called and said she loves going to South America and to San Francisco, and even though she suffers from depression, maybe that might be one of the reasons that people find their happy places someplace else is yeah. because they find such a difference from what we live with here in the States. Everything is just so crazy. And when they get to go away, they get to disconnect from that craziness in their everyday lives. And that's why it's they find their happy place. And I just wanted to comment on what Karma had said about, you know, this concept of personal happiness.
Bernice?
And that, yes.
Let me step. Forgive me. We're about out of time.
Okay.
So we'll just take that other comment. It's a great one. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let me ask you, Eric Weiner, we've got less than a minute left here.
Right.
You say, you know, it was a long 10 countries, tens of thousands of miles. You say that you're sort of relearning the pleasures of home. How did the journey change you, do you think? Do you feel more happy, less grumpy, or as less of a mope, I guess?
Malcontent, right?
Yeah, that's it.
I would say I'm not happy, but I'm less unhappy. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I've tried as best I can to sort of internalize the lessons from the road. I'll just give you one brief example. I know we don't have much time. The other day my iPod crashed. I lost 2,000 songs and didn't back them up and started cursing as I usually do. But then I found myself just saying, you know, my pen lie, which is a Thai expression that means essentially just let it go.
Yeah.
And I was surprised that I hadn't heard the expression in months. I hadn't been in Thailand for a while, but there it was. So clearly something registered with me. And
yeah.
And so, yeah, I am definitely less unhappy.
Eric Weiner, national correspondent for NPR. His book is called The Geography of Bliss. Eric, thanks very much.
Thanks, Doug. It's been a pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Jonathan Paxton, the program directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.